Now that I've been teaching for so long and getting older and older, it's a great happiness for me that some of my students are teaching. And Philippa is the one that does most teaching here in Australia of my students. There's also Anya, but she always has to go back and forth because she's Dutch and she can't stay. So Philippa does the most of it. And so that's, I'm very happy about that. In Germany I have lots of students teaching. Something not working right properly, Bronwyn? Sorry? A little louder. Oh, they can't hear. Yeah. Yeah. Before I actually start on talking about the Dhamma, maybe telling you a little bit about what I do in Germany is interesting. I don't know, I'll keep it very short in case it isn't. But the interest in the Dhamma in Germany is overwhelming. Nothing compared to what goes on here in Australia. I haven't had an audience of 20 or 25 people in years. When I give a talk in Germany, it's more like between 200 and 800. I gave a talk the other day. Where was I? Many cities everywhere. Oh, in Berlin, my hometown. And in a little theater. And it was sold out weeks earlier. They had to pay $10, 10 marks to get in. And it seated 600 people. And I gave a talk in Lindau, which is not far from Buddha House in the south of Germany, and also in one of those little theaters, and there were 700 people. And I quite often get invited to go to a bookshop, because that way they can sell my books better, naturally. And I don't mind, because I mean, after all, I've written the silly things, so they might as well get sold, you know. So they never have less than 200 people. And they're very keen for me to come, because that way they really sell the books. And so I go when it's possible. It's, so the interest is enormous. I have also aroused the interest of the media to quite an exaggerated extent. If that happened, would have happened to me when I was younger, I probably would have got conceited. Now that's out of the question. So it's a good thing it happens to me now. There was I've been on numbers of television shows, and whenever that happens, the phone at Buddha House rings incessantly, and my poor Gudrun has really to work her head off to try and send out the information to everybody. We've just had a show on the 16th of January. I wasn't there, but I have the video. It was sent to me. I have it here in Brisbane, of that television show. And it's a 45-minute, what they call a profile, on my life. And it's quite nice. My son had a lot of things to complain about, which he didn't like. He thought it was too many flowers and a bit of kitsch here and all that. But I think they did quite a nice job on it. And actually, it shows me at what Buddha Dhamma, the day before I left for Sri Lanka to be ordained. And that was the day of the wedding of John and, what was her name, Bridget. They're long divorced, of course. But anyway, that was the day they got married, and I was wearing a sari and long black hair. And then that was at the Watt. And then they also showed a photo of my cootie at the Watt in that television show. And so it's quite nice. I mean, it's, the way they've done it, I thought it was quite clever, you know, using old photos and things. So since that happened, the phone has again been ringing incessantly. And not only that, but my German books have been selling enormously well. People order 30 and 40 at a time. Not people. These are distributors for bookshops. And they order 30 and 40 at a time and distribute them to the bookshops. And seeing I've put a lot of time and effort into these books, I'm very happy if they get sold. And also, at this time in my life, I don't feel so energetic anymore as I used to. I'll be 73 this August, and I've had 4 operations, so I'm not feeling... Well, I'm feeling all right. I'm not sick or anything, but I don't have a lot of energy. And so I use time for books because I can reach a lot of people with the Dhamma then, with the books, even more than with the tapes. We sell thousands of tapes in Germany, and I'm not exaggerating because that too is lying, exaggerating. So, we sell about 4,000 tapes a year minimum of my Dhamma talks. But even that doesn't go as far as the books, because people might listen to them once and then not again. Whereas with the books, they give them to other people, and they I think they are very effective in really propagating the Dhamma. And in Germany, yes, in Central Europe, I would say, well, there's somebody in Holland, but there's very little Theravadin teaching. What they had until not so long ago has been Zen and, of course, Tibetan. Tibetan lamas are everywhere, but most of them don't speak a single word of German. And if they do, I don't understand what they're saying. And most of them don't even know English. And the Germans, although they all claim that they know English, don't really know English. They all think they do, but they don't really, unless they've been in England or America. You can tell by the books they pick, because we have my English books there too, but they never sell. They don't go anywhere. So the lamas are very... there's a lot of that going on in Germany and in the other countries around, like Switzerland and Austria. In Austria not so much, but Switzerland and Holland. And there's a lot of Zen. But Theravadin is markedly lagging behind. So when I arrived in Germany 6 years ago and started teaching the Theravadin teaching, people were very surprised, and it seems to really touch them, because it's, well, it's Western. It's very Western, the way I teach, of course, and I'm born to the language. I was born to the German language, and the results have been really very fascinating. This new Metta-Vihara, this new forest monastery, I like to say something about that because it's very dear to my heart. It's a 90-year-old vision by Venerable Nana Tiloka. Venerable Nana Tiloka was the first German monk, and he became a monk in 1903 in Burma, and he was the teacher of the Venerable Nana Ponika. Nana Ponika just died last year at the age of 93. And Nana Tiloka always had the vision that he wanted to make a forest monastery in Germany. But two world wars intervened and never got around to it. And also he was interned by the British, because the British couldn't, although they had great freedom and could do what they like, they were still Germans, and they got interned. And Nana Panika did too, together with Lama Govinda. And they were all spending their war years together in these internment camps and did most of their translations there. Mm. And so Nana Tiloka has translated from Pali, he was a real Pali scholar, numbers of scriptures which have never been published. And I've made it my business to have them published in German. They would be a great bestseller. They're extremely scholarly, and I don't think I'll ever read them. They're the Abhidhamma and that type of thing. But I think it was necessary, even as an honor to him and to the work he has done, that they should finally be published. So we have published his translation of the Dhammapada, which is very nice, and people do buy that. And it's published in a big volume and in a small one also that you can stick in your pocket, which is really nice. And we have published four talks of his about karma and rebirth. And we have now published the Abhidhammata Sangaha, which is, as the word tells you, Abhidhamma, and it's a sort of compilation of seven Abhidhamma books. The Pali canon, which is a basis for Theravadin teaching, consists of three parts. It's called the Tipitaka. T is three, and Pitaka basket, three baskets. And that's the Vinaya, the rules for monks and nuns, the suttas, the discourses by the Buddha, and the Abhidhamma. Abhi is higher, Dhamma, higher Dhamma. It's a philosophical treatise on the suttas. And nothing of that has ever been translated into German, and these manuscripts have been lying around for the past 50 years. And so we finally got it published just 2 weeks before I left. It's something for people who really want to get into the study of it. He had this vision for 90 years ago that he wanted to make this forest monastery. It never happened. So now we're doing it. And I feel very happy about that. And I feel that I'll probably be alive long enough. In fact, I'm sure I'll be alive long enough to see the see it finished. It's we have 22 acres in Germany. It's hectares. I never quite know what it is, but it's 20 acres. Let's say 20 acres, and forest, and meadows, and a creek, and a 11-bedroom house, which is a 300-year-old farmhouse, which was transformed or changed into a small hotel and restaurant by the former owners, and they went bankrupt because they couldn't look after it anymore. They got old, and the bank made a compulsory auction at which we bought it. It's about half an hour from Buddha House in the south of Germany, in the foothills of the Alps. You're on a clear day, you can see the snow-covered Alps from every window. And it's totally isolated. You don't see another house. You don't hear any cars, nothing. There's no proper road. There's only our own road that leads to it. And yet it's only 20 minutes from the main town in the south of, in Bavaria, from Kempten, from the railhead. It's only 20 minutes to the railhead. So it's a beautiful location. And here in Australia, that doesn't seem so strange. because this is still a country where there's a lot of land available, even though it might not be in the right place where one wants it. But in Germany, there's no land available. It's overpopulated. And to be able to find a place like that, which is just exactly what we wanted, is almost like a miracle. And also, I mean, it costs a lot of money, of course, but we got it comparatively cheaper because it was on auction. So what is happening now, it's getting totally renovated inside, and in spring it will be renovated outside. And what the plan for it is, well, anybody wants to be monk or nun can come and first live there for a year and see if they really want to be it. And also, we offer the place as a monastery on time. So what I envision is that people can come when it's finished for a minimum of 1 month. Don't think I need to set a maximum, whatever time they've got, to have a really retreat from the world. And as I say, we have 11 bedrooms there. So at the moment, we don't have to think of adding to that, because I don't think there'll be that many people all at once. And we'll see what happens. So at the moment, we have a lot of my students also working there for free, which is very helpful. And we have some real tradesmen that get paid a lot of money. And we have some tradesmen that are friends who work for very little. So it's we have about 4, 5, 6, sometimes 8 people working there at the same time. And it's all going on very well. And I think it will be very beautiful. In fact, it is very beautiful, except that it's not livable yet. It's still a bit of a mess. But so that is actually something that I'm extremely happy about, that this can come about sort of at the end of my life. And we were keen on it, but nothing offered itself, and then this happened. So these are the things that are happening in Germany. And of course, I don't know if you know, but some of you do, German is the language that is most spoken in Central Europe. It's not English. Everybody knows a little bit of English. They can all say, you know, what time it is and how to buy apples. But the language which is mostly spoken in the center of Europe is German. Dutch people speak German. They all speak German. The Swiss, the only real language that they have in common is German, because they speak different languages in Switzerland. Austrians, is their language is German. In Hungary, half of Hungary speaks German. In Poland, that used to be Germany, western part of Poland speaks German. So, and Germany is in the middle of it all, in the middle of Europe. So we do have a lot of people coming from everywhere now that the borders are all open. That also hasn't happened before. I mean, for you, this is all far removed, isn't it? But Europe has been little tiny countries for ever so long. And it's the whole of Europe is, well, it might be the size of Australia, I'm not quite sure. But it's all divided up into different languages, different countries, different currencies. Wherever you went, you had to show your passport and get a visa and be asked a lot of silly questions. That's no more. You can, practically all the borders are open. And they are very diligently working on a united Europe with one currency, and they'll never make one language. But the one most spoken is German. They'll never manage to have one language. But they want one currency and no more passports and visas. So that's really a great step forward in peacefulness, one can hope. And I was at a peace university in Berlin, which was a beautiful concept didn't work out the way it was conceived. Where everybody was talking about whatever it is that they're doing so that they could help peace along. But it's strange because the people who were there and were giving talks were all fantastic people. There was Pir Inyat Khan, he's the head of the Sufi movement, and Raymond Panikkar, who's a well-known, very well-known religious philosopher, I suppose you could say. There were 7 Nobel Prize winners. Everybody you could find, really. And still, the thing really didn't get completely off the ground. And there was a lot of controversy about it, too. So a peace university with controversy is a great pity, isn't it? Well, I said my piece, as usual, and I did the loving-kindness meditation, as usual, and there were 200 people, 300 people listening, and I thought it was well worth it, and wandered around my hometown, which is the biggest building site in the world. There's no bigger building site than Berlin. There's building going on everywhere. It's quite amazing. And it was very interesting. And I thought it was, you know, well worth my efforts to go there. It was strenuous. It's very strenuous, but it was well worth it. So all these things are happening in Europe, and I think that they're promising. They're promising for a better better world community. Although, what's also happening in Europe is, right next door to Germany, they're killing each other. There's a war going on. And they haven't been able to stop it. I mean, everybody has tried, and it's still going on. And sometimes they think it's a religious war, but actually what it is, it's more an ethnic war. They want to have their own countries. The Croatians and the Serbians don't want to live together. Same thing everywhere, all the time. So in spite of all these efforts that people are making, that is also happening. And that's the Dhamma, isn't it? We all have the good roots and the unwholesome roots in us. What I thought I'd like to talk... Sorry if I've taken up too much time with all these just news items. But I thought maybe it's interesting, especially for those of you who had come to Germany and been with me in Germany. It's more interesting for you. I want to give an overview of what the Dhamma contains. I've done that before, and obviously in 21 or 22 years of teaching, I've done all of it before. And sometimes I feel as if I'm a used-up record saying the same things over and over again. But I have felt that this overview is quite important to give one, if one wants to, give one an insight into what one actually has to do in order to internalize the Dhamma. There was an interesting item, I'll get back to some of these news items again. There was an interesting item in the most prestigious German newspaper while the Peace University was going on. And this prestigious German newspaper, which is usually quite bland about religious things, said, well, even the Dalai Lama is always saying the same thing. Well, yeah. Of course he is. I mean, what else is there to say? And then I said, you know, the bestseller of all times has been the Bible. And I thought the Bible had been translated into over 300 languages. But the people who were on the platform with me immediately interjected and said, no, 1,264 languages. I can't imagine, but anyway, I said, all right. And it's a bestseller of all times. It's the most read book ever. It's the first printed book. The first book that was ever printed, the Gutenberg Bible. And what happened? People read it. And then they say, oh yes, that's right. And then they go about their business with the same roots of evil as they had before. So whether the Dalai Lama keeps saying the same thing, whether the Buddha keeps saying the same thing, or at the tail end of all this, whether I keep saying the same thing, really makes no difference. One's got to do it. And that's the most important part of the Dhamma, that we have to do it, each one for ourselves. Naturally, the guidelines that we get from the Buddha are extremely important. They are, so to say, the core and essence of it all, that we have those guidelines. If we didn't have those guidelines, we probably couldn't do it at all. I know I couldn't. I wouldn't have a clue. When I heard the Buddha's teachings for the first time, I thought to myself, that's right. That's something I really can do, and I can really try and follow that. Naturally, some things we can do on our own. We all have a conscience, and we can try and live with that conscience, and we do. But to go beyond that, we really need some guidance. But that's it. That's all it is. The Buddha calls himself just the shower of the way. We can believe what he says. We can disbelieve what he says. We can argue about it. We can write about it. We can learn it by heart. It doesn't make any difference. If we don't do it, it makes no difference whatsoever. And again, it shows that even there, where the teaching of the Buddha is well established, if the people don't do it, there's chaos, absolute chaos. So we have actually an advantage. We don't have an old established Buddhist tradition in the West. So nothing of what we hear about the Dhamma is sort of mechanical. All that we can latch on to is something that we may have felt within and then get it confirmed by the Buddha's teaching. And that way we have a better opportunity to really practice it. The practice of the Dhamma consists of three parts. Wherever you look in the Dhamma, it's always three parts. It's always Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. Sila is moral conduct, and Samadhi is concentration, and Panya is inside wisdom. The word Panya means wisdom, but inside wisdom is a better way of realizing what is meant. These three are always within every teaching the Buddha gave. And any spiritual teaching that doesn't contain those three isn't worth paying attention to. It's got to contain those threes. It's got to contain moral conduct, the way we behave. It's got to contain the meditation, the concentration, and it has to contain the insight arising. Now, in the Buddha's teaching, we find it over and over again, and we can look at it in this way. Our moral behavior, our everyday behavior, the way we act with other people, is a foundation. It's what we actually found and base our life on. And if that's not in order, we can't go on. Because first of all, we'll feel agitated. We'll feel probably also some remorse, regret. Maybe we feel anger and hate towards some imaginary person who is supposedly the causation of all that. But if we get our behavior to the point where we can look upon it with equanimity, and where we can, at night when we go to bed, recapitulate the whole day and are quite contented with the way we have conducted ourselves, then we have a good foundation for a spiritual life. I often recommend that we can, in the evening, sort of make a balance sheet. We can do it in our mind, we can do it on a piece of paper, whatever we like. Some people like to use pen and paper, some people just do it in their heads. What went on all day? And whether all the confrontations that one has had, and everybody has confrontations, nobody gets away without them, whether we have mastered them, whether we were equanimous about them, whether we could be loving about them to other people, or whether we got irate and angry and upset and nervous and agitated and restless and worried, or whatever else have we done. And have a look and see what actually happened during this one day. And then, if we find any of the things that happened that we are not too happy about, which we think, oh, well, I could have done that one better, no need to blame ourselves. None whatsoever. The only thing that's necessary is to recognize. Recognition, no blame, change. There's nothing to blame. There's nobody there to blame anyway, but that's a later aspect of the teaching. But it's useless to blame, because blaming is also negative. And if we've already done something negative and then blame on top of it, we've got two negativities instead of one. And why should we blame ourselves? It's already happened. What we can do is recognition, and then make a determination, saying, well, that one wasn't very useful, I won't repeat it. And instead, I repeat all the things which are useful. I like to compare that to a shopkeeper who makes a balance sheet in the evening in his shop and looks at all the things that were sold and that really went well, that people really wanted to buy. And then he looks at the rest of the stuff that's sitting there and been sitting there for weeks. Well, if he were to reorder those things that are sitting there for weeks, be very foolish, wouldn't it? So he's going to reorder those things that everybody wants. Well, what does everybody want? Everybody wants lovingness, helpfulness, a way of being together which is harmonious. Well, we can reorder that without any trouble. But any of the other stuff, much better just to leave it where it is. But not blaming oneself. That's not the idea behind it all. It just is. And if we were to blame ourselves for everything we've ever done wrong, only in this one lifetime, we'd never get out of blaming ourselves. It's a futile assignment. And then if we add to that all the lifetimes we already had before that, I mean, it's just hopeless. It's totally hopeless. It's useless. So we just look at this one day and we see what went on. And if it all was harmonious and loving, and if our inner reality was one of steadfastness, patience, perseverance, giving, oh, we're happy about it. And then we have a good chance in meditation. And we can look upon this whole thing as a foundation, a bridge, and the other side of the bridge, the goal. The foundation, this side of the bridge, is our behavior. The bridge towards insight is the meditation. And insight is where we're trying to get to. It's, so to say, the other side of the bridge, or the other bank of the river, as it is usually called. But if we think of a bridge, we can say we'll walk over the bridge and come to the other side of the river. Meditation is not a goal in itself. It's not a purpose in itself. It's a means. It's an absolutely essential means, but it's not the purpose of the whole Dhamma. The reason why it is an absolutely essential means is because it's the only way we can ever get from the worldly duality thinking to the higher level of consciousness, which is unity consciousness, which has nothing to do with enlightenment or insight. It's just a different way of having awareness. Here the word consciousness is being used as awareness. Now we know the awareness we have every day. We don't even have to talk about it. Everybody is other than we are ourselves. This is me and this is everybody else. And our optics seem to prove that. Everybody is a little lump by themselves. But that's just an optical illusion. In reality, we know already from our scientists that there isn't a single solid building block in the whole of the universe. Everything are energy particles that come together and fall apart. Now, if those scientists who formulated these words would have taken themselves as an example of that, they might be enlightened today. But what they actually did was, they just specified that that's the way it is in the universe, forgetting that they themselves are part of the universe, and are exactly the same, and so are we. Our optics tell us that we are all separate. And our ego illusion tells us the same thing. Because we have that illusion that we are a separate entity, it also tells us that we have to protect the special entity that we are. And that the special entity that we are wants things, needs things, is going to get things, is going to become somebody, is somebody, knows things, all sorts of ideas we have about the special entity. And in our daily life, that, of course, manifests in our duality consciousness that here's me and there's you, and here's us and there's them, and here I am and out there's nature, which is one of the reasons why we have played such havoc with nature, killing rainforests and polluting streams and all that sort of thing, because we don't realize that we are nature. We think that's out there and we are in here. Our everyday consciousness is always concerned with how am I going to do the best for this person? How am I going to get somewhere? How am I going to become that what I want to be? Even though we may not notice it, that we're doing that, it's always concerned with that. And because we can't be sure, we can never be sure that this I, this person, is going to get what it wants and get rid of what it doesn't want, we are never totally at ease. There's always unrest. There's a feeling of agitation inside. There's never a total peacefulness. And because none of us have total peacefulness, there's never total peacefulness in the world, because we are the world. One person that gains total peacefulness makes peace for the world. Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the peacemakers. But you've got to have the peace within. You can't make it out there. You've got to have it inside. And most people are perfectly happy to agree to that. Even the United Nations have it in their preamble. What has that helped? Not much, has it? I mean, maybe a little, I don't know, but Not much. I went there once in New York, 1987, to the United Nations building and gave a talk there. None of the big countries sent a representative to listen. Only the small ones. And I don't think I made any impression on them. But anyway, I tried. So it was very interesting for me to be there. It was most interesting. The way I got there was because the ambassador for the United Nations from Sri Lanka was a friend of mine. And so he invited me to come. Otherwise, I would never have got there. So this ordinary, everyday duality consciousness, everybody carries it around with them. Everybody knows that everybody's got it. And it's constantly playing havoc with our inner peace and inner joy, because we need something, we think, from outside that's going to make us happy. Something that comes through our senses. Either seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, or thinking. Something that's going to come in from out there and really make us happy. And it doesn't work. It never has worked and never will. Because even if we do, and there's no reason why we don't, get pleasant sensations and pleasant sense contacts, how long do they last? They're all very brief, and we have to renew them. And so we spend time and energy, the whole world, everybody does, time and energy on getting the pleasures from outside to come in. It doesn't make us happy. It gives pleasure. And so, in order to find a totally different dimension of insight, we do need the meditation. Because that different dimension of insight will not come by itself. It is said in the scriptures that sometimes people have meditated in their past lives and they gain insight without meditating in this life. But these are rare exceptions. And I would think, that's my personal thought, that in this day and age of technology, which is actually our religious, such exceptions would be almost impossible to find. We have a technocratic society and not a spiritual society. And those people who really want to know the spiritual truths are still in the minority. I told you about a lot of interest in Germany, that 600-700 people come to a talk, but there are 80 million Germans. So the still minority, a great minority. And so we need the meditative mind, the calm mind, so that we can see something different, that we can have finally an experience of unity. When we get an experience of unity, we see the world in a different light. When the mind becomes concentrated, after it's been thinking and pondering and arguing and resisting and labeling and all doing all sorts of things which all minds do when they first start meditating, and it's finally given up all this and finally said, well, all right, then I'll get concentrated, it's too bothersome, and just do it, then we have that opportunity, the opportunity of having a totally different awareness. And that totally different awareness brings us to an understanding of a different dimension, which is always present, that different dimension. But we never relate to it in daily living. We never think of it even, unless we meditate successfully every day. And then, when we do, we can take that different dimension into daily life, which doesn't mean that we have to remove ourselves from daily living. Not at all. And it doesn't mean that we are disgusted with the world or anything like that. Because disgust is also negative, and negativity doesn't help. But what it means is that we see the things that are happening in the world in a different light. I very often compare it to playing with a child. I have ample opportunity at the moment to play with small children. I've got two grandchildren. One is 1.5 and one is 5. And so the 1.5-year-old, of course, likes to build towers with blocks and gets quite irate when the tower falls together and it all goes to pieces because he's still fairly clumsy. That happens every time a tower falls to bits. So the child screams, obviously. What do I do? I try to soothe him and try to tell him it's not very terrible that the tower fell to bits. We can make a new one, and it's not so important, and we'll try and do something else. Well, that's the way we see the world when we've seen a different dimension. Everybody's trying to build towers, and everybody's towers fall to bits, and it doesn't really matter. We can soothe them, we can help them. We can try to show them how to build a better tower if they are insisting on building a tower. But we can also tell them, don't scream, it doesn't matter. There'll always be another tower, but the reality lies somewhere else. And this is how we take the different dimension of the meditation into daily living. And that means that all our confrontations that we have in daily living, and everybody has them, there's no doubt about it, if we don't have too many people that we meet every day, we don't have that many confrontations. But we always have to confront ourselves. There's always something going on inside. We always have to confront that all the time. So those things we see that they're just games. They're not the real thing. The real thing is further, beyond the...